And welcome to this month's episode of Peter Neuwirth's Retirement Income Strategy Show. Pete is an author and actuary. I'm Hope Katz-Gibbs, producer of the show on the Incandescent Radio Network and Incandescent TV. We are so thrilled to have tonight's guest, Mendel Meltzer. He is the chief investment officer of a company called Capacuity. It's a national executive benefits consulting firm based in Central Florida. And I'm just going to throw it right over to you, Pete, because you have this amazing Q&A prepared for you and Mendel, because you are also at Capacuity. So tell us a little bit about the firm and take it away.
Well, thanks a lot, Hope. And thank you, Mendel, for joining me. I'm very excited to have Mendel here as a guest. And as Hope said, Mendel and I worked together at Capacuity, and we started quite a while ago. We were both recruited by a kind of a remarkable guy who started the firm back in 2018. Mendel was there just slightly before me, and he was brought on as the chief investment officer, and I came on as the senior consulting actuary. And Capacuity basically manages the supply chain of executive retirement plans, mostly non-qualified deferred comp plans. And as I say, we started in 2018, and we're still there. 6 years later, Capacuity has grown substantially and now has, I think, about $7 billion of assets under management, and is a real national player. And today, we're going to be talking about the investment aspects of retirement income strategy. And we have in Mendel a guy who has managed a lot of money. At one point, he was managing almost $200 billion for a large insurance carrier. And I would like to just start by, again, welcoming you, Mendel, and asking you to tell us a little bit about how you got to Capacuity and what you were doing along the way.
Well, thank you very much, Pete. And to both Pete and Hope, thank you so much for having me on this podcast. This is my first podcast that I'm actually a speaking participant on, so I'm kind of excited about it. I had an interesting path to get to Capacuity, where we essentially do investment consulting with large companies who are managing their deferred compensation plans around the funding and the hedging and also the investments of them. But I didn't start out in that kind of an investment consulting role. Back in the 80s, I joined Prudential and spent many years on both the private side and the public side of Prudential, so both doing deals and managing portfolios, and ultimately was chief investment officer of the mutual funds and annuity area, where we ran about $180 billion. So that's where that number comes from, Pete, that you mentioned. From there, I spent some time in a sort of a more entrepreneurial setting, doing hedge funds and private equity at a firm called Weiss, Peck & Greer, and then decided to hang up my membership in the New York City environment and moved down to Florida for a company where I started up an investment consulting business and ultimately moved to Capacuity. So that was sort of my route, Pete. Started in asset management and then moved really to investment consulting.
And you help essentially choose the managers or manage the managers, or I mean, what is it that you do right now in terms of investment management? I mean, you're the chief investment officer, so.
Sure. It really covers a broad array of items. I would say the most basic is that every one of these plans has to be in sync from an asset and liability perspective and needs assets that hedge the liabilities without causing undue volatility between the two. And that sort of process is the bread and butter of what we're doing. But then it extends from there. With some clients, we're actually choosing or recommending, not choosing, but recommending the investments that are on the menu for the executives to choose from. In many situations, we're working with corporate-oriented plans where it's not participants in company, but rather the company has a, some sort of a, you know, defined benefit type obligation, and they need to invest the money to achieve the rate of return that's assumed in the liability. So we really kind of cover a number of different areas of investment consulting.
Right. And so I think you bring up an important point there, which is that investments, you know, how you develop an investment strategy or what you, how you invest assets really has to do with what is it, what are those assets for? And as you said, you helped the investment of many, many assets at Prudential, and Prudential, they have liabilities that they have to use those assets to pay off, whether they're life insurance policies or annuities or what have you. So my basic question, and the question I think our audience will be most interested in, is as you look at the problem of investing assets and generating, you know, a good return for those that are investing the assets, how does the problem of investing differ during the accumulation phase for an individual versus the decumulation phase when they're drawing it down and actually have to live on those assets?
Right. I mean, that is a great question, Pete. And you know, unfortunately, our asset management businesses around the country are oriented toward the former, toward the accumulation of assets. And so, you know, the most sort of correct way to describe it is during that accumulation phase, you want to get the highest level of expected return for the given level of volatility with which you're comfortable. And that sort of defines the problem. It's not simple, it's not a simple problem to solve, but it defines the problem around the accumulation phase. And so there's nothing wrong with taking more risk in order to get more reward, you know, if you are sort of tolerant of the volatility that comes with that. But in the decumulation phase, you know, it's a whole different situation, because now you're no longer bringing in money into the pool, you're spending money from the pool. And if that pool has a hiccup, the penalty to the pensioner or the retiree, I should say, the penalty to the retiree is much more severe than it would be during the accumulation phase, because during the accumulation phase, you've got plenty of room to go. So, you know, you have a little hiccup and you recover from it, and it's not the end of the world. In the decumulation phase, that's very different. And so I like to say that during the decumulation phase, you really want to focus on not taking any more risk than is necessary to have funds to fill the liabilities you expect in retirement. So there's no benefit, there's no bonus for taking another unit of extra risk.
Right. Well, that's it's so interesting how and again, what I think is useful and interesting about our dialogue is I think actuaries tend to think of these things in a slightly different way than investment professionals, because we don't think about things in terms of volatility so much as in terms of the risk itself. And we're very, very focused on identifying specific risks associated, not so much on the assets, but mostly on the liability and the cash flow side. So for example, I think the risk that you identified, the hiccup that you talked about, what actuaries think about as sequence of return risk. And maybe that's a term that's also in your world as well. But there's lots of different risks. I mean, there's sequence of return risk. There's what I would call spike expense risk. There's other contingencies, and there's longevity. So as a general rule, if you have a series of risks in the decumulation, do you see different techniques or different investment techniques to address each of those different risks? Or is it kind of one size, just risk is risk and invest the assets attentive, as you say, reducing risk in the decumulation phase? Or do you ever kind of segment the buckets, segment the assets, and think about addressing different risks in different ways?
I'm an asset manager and an institutional investment consultant, and I've never really served as an advisor to high net worth or, individuals in that sort of category. But what I would say is that the concept of identifying what your lifestyle spend is going to be and bringing that back to the present value as a liability, and then taking a look at the cash flows you might generate from your assets and doing the same thing, is a very healthy exercise to anyone. As for, looking at sort of very specific risks, I can't say I've spent a lot of time, but I will say that longevity insurance is a very interesting product out there. And the reason why is my belief is the things that you need to insure are those things that are catastrophic. The day-to-day sort of expenses that you might have is not worth really insuring for what the cost might be. And so if what you say is, and this would be applicable to anybody who has, only, not only, but a reasonable amount of assets to get them into retirement without much of an excess. To the extent you say, gee, I'll use all of my assets up by 85, right? And, I'll just invest them, in a laddered bond portfolio or, whatever I need to invest them in to cover my liabilities till I'm 85. And then if I buy longevity insurance, which is essentially a deferred annuity at 85 to go for the rest of my life, then I've covered off that risk and I haven't had to sacrifice my assets.
So it sounds like you do believe a little bit in insurance or longevity insurance at least. And longevity is an interesting risk because, it's not catastrophic. It's a kind of a creeping catastrophe, if you will, because, you get to 85 and then you live to 86 and 87. And by the time you get to 100, you don't have, you're all out of money. And that really is a catastrophe. But what about the other risks? Long-term care as a risk, some other kinds of big spike expenses that could occur. Do you believe in that a portion of a portfolio should be allocated to directly insuring some of those risks?
Yeah, I mean that kind of gets a little bit out of my wheelhouse. But in general, what I believe about various types of personal insurance is that if I could just fund the outcome myself, and it's not really going to hurt me, then it probably isn't worth to insure it because the insurer is going to have to make some profit margin on it. So, sure, I'd look at, all sorts of I mean, take trip insurance, as an example. And do you do that? Well, it's really expensive, but, the result of not doing it is pretty high. And, they're very personal decisions. Some people have the assets to not really require that kind of insurance. And some people, they are very sensitive to movements and they need to smooth out those payments or those expenses through insurance.
Now, I guess I'm going to throw you a little bit of a curveball here because this is not a question that I warned you about. But it seems to me inflation is also a risk, or at least people characterize inflation as a risk. What is your view of inflation as a risk, and how do you address that from an investment strategy perspective?
Now that is actually much more sort of in the wheelhouse of investing. Inflation is absolutely a risk. And portfolios that I've been responsible for constructing, dating back to when I moved to the investment consulting business back in 2002, have always had an appropriate amount of treasury inflation protected securities, which is really the only security out there that not its market value, but its book value kind of keeps up with inflation. And I think that's, a very important component. And most investment practitioners do include such a thing now.
So I've heard it said that stocks are a good risk. I mean, investment hedge that that the stock market will ultimately rise, and as opposed to bonds, which would get pretty well hammered under inflation. Is that a misconception on my part?
I mean, take a look at stocks in 2002. Inflation was showing its ugly head, and stocks, retreated for pretty much the full year. So, I mean, that's just one anecdote, but it happens to be a very recent one. Stocks represent the collective psychology of people buying and selling them. They don't necessarily respond to fundamentals of the economy or fundamentals, of the company. You look at, what happened with GameStop as an example. So I don't, I wouldn't, I think if you want to hedge inflation, you need an instrument that locks into inflation.
And that instrument you were saying is it that's tips or what is that?
Tips, yeah.
Okay. But
Individuals can do a certain amount of I bonds also, but it's not going to move the needle on a large portfolio. But basically something that credits you the increase in the CPI to me is hedging inflation.
okay, cool. All right, let's shift a little bit back to the clients that we work with at Capacuity. These are basically high net worth individuals or the participants in these deferred comp plans. And those basically any participant in a deferred comp plan is likely to have lots of different buckets. Their deferred comp, maybe their 401k, maybe their stock in the company, and so on and so forth. Would you advise an individual who has lots and lots of buckets to have lots and lots of different investment strategies, or how would you talk to somebody like that?
I was very lucky to have been associated with a firm that kind of helped come up with buckets, and they're a little bit of a different bucket than you're describing, Pete. Rather than the bucket be here's my stock and here are my bonds and here are these other things, it's the bucket for a particular goal. So it's my retirement bucket, it's my second home bucket, or it's my boat bucket. And when you make them tangible like that, you can talk to people about how the risk profiles should differ based upon the bucket. So the retirement bucket is, going to be kind of conservative, right? You're going to want to, get a levelized payment off during retirement. But the boat bucket, on the other hand, you can afford to be a little bit more aggressive on that because, the worst that happens, you get a smaller boat, or if things go well, you get a bigger boat. And you don't, it's not like retirement. And so having those buckets in the plan allows a participant to surgically sort of approach the risk tolerance that they have for that particular goal.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing that's of course more complicated for an executive is the distributions, and the distribution options from a lot of these deferred comp plans are not the same. You can't just sort of just draw down what you want when you want from a deferred comp plan because you have to elect the distributions in advance. So, would you suggest, I mean, how early on would you suggest somebody, particularly a deferred comp participant, start to think about their decumulation strategy and how to position their investments for the long term?
All right. Well, now you're really outside of my area of expertise. So
Okay.
therefore, I'll offer an opinion. Section 409A is a very challenging and complicated, piece of regulation, and I'm not an expert in it, but it does prescribe, how far in advance you need to make those elections. You can elect it when you defer it, and then if you change that election, then you kind of reset the clock in terms of not being able to. I don't know all the specifics, but that's why you need kind of people on the plan who understand how to run the plan, because the deferred comp plan offers a great deal of flexibility, but you need to be cognizant of the tripwires that are involved.
Right. Yeah. I guess, like I said, I think the and I've given some presentations on, high net worth, retirement income strategies for high net worth versus others who have a more simplified situation. But it's, the cash flow needs of the executive are also more complicated, more varied. And again, I believe that, this retirement income strategy, particularly on the decumulation side, starts with a clear and detailed projection of what is your cash flow needs and what are the risks and what are the variabilities associated with, and then, integrating it with an investment strategy. So I think this is a very useful conversation. With the time we have left, I was wondering if you could share, because it's, for my benefit as well, what is your view of the current environment out there, and what the outlook is, you know, economically, investment wise, inflation wise, and can you share a little bit of what's in your crystal ball?
Well, I can, but before I do that, Pete, I want to really emphasize that nobody should make an investment decision based upon their current perception of the environment or any expert's, you know, assumption. They should be making their investment decisions based upon their risk tolerance and the investments that they're getting into, and making sure that those investments are consistent with their risk tolerance. So that's true whether you're extremely bullish and extremely bearish. I mean, with that said, the economy is doing, you know, pretty well. You know, and I think that's great. I mean, we've got, you know, consumers are spending money at a healthy pace, which is, you know, keeping things moving. Unemployment is at an incredible level on the low side. Inflation is coming back, you know, toward that 2% Federal Reserve level. It's not there yet, and you know, they maybe have to raise rates a little bit in order to get it there. But I mean, that doesn't throw me out of kilter if that's the case. But you know, they're raising it for a good reason, which is that the economy is strong, and you know, so all of those things, you know, are good. The one concern that, you know, I would mention, I guess, is that you know, equity valuations are pretty high, and you know, they were this high in 2021, leading into 2022, and you know, the market did have a substantial correction in 2022. And I guess, you know, I grew up thinking about investments from a very much of a valuation perspective. You know, if I were paying, you know, kind of full value or more, then I'm not going to get as good of returns. If I'm paying somehow less than full value, than I am. And that's kind of the way I look at the market. Now, that's not to say that just because the valuations are high, that's not to say that tomorrow the market's going to turn around. What it does mean, and what there has been a lot of research done about, particularly when you take into account a long-term valuation ratio, like the Shiller price earnings ratio. It's a 10-year real earnings price ratio. That when that ratio is high going in, that future returns are lower. And when it's low going in, then future returns are higher. And I tend to subscribe to that notion. So what I would say is that, you know, we've had some very good years, and that's pushed valuations up higher. And so now probably, no, there's no certainty on this kind of thing, but probably, you know, the prospective returns over the next decade might be more muted than what people have experienced. But, you know, the economy, I've got no complaints, and, you know, the market seems to be keeping up.
What about interest rates, and what about the yield curve? Because it feels like the yield curve has been inverted, and we're with short-term rates higher than long-term rates for longer than I can remember in my 40 years of doing actuarial work. Do you see the yield curve normalizing anytime soon? And if so, how do you expect that to manifest?
You asked two very separate questions. You said, do you see the yield curve normalizing? And then you said, anytime soon.
Okay.
And so yes, I do see it normalizing, because quite frankly, the upward sloping yield curve that we all consider to be normal is because long-term investors need to be compensated for taking less liquidity and more volatility being out the curve. So they need a higher, you know, rate of return. So I do see that. I have no idea when that's going to happen. You know, I'm shocked that it hasn't happened already. And as for predicting which way they go, I've always believed that the best estimate of the future expected return on a fixed income security is the current yield to worst, and not to try to forecast sort of, you know, gains or losses.
Even in a situation where you know there's, I mean, I kind of look at it as the physics of interest rates, that, you know, it's got to revert eventually for exactly the reasons that you
sure.
mentioned, that people will demand a premium to loan money for a very long time. So, I mean, doesn't that, I mean, again, this is kind of just simplistically thinking, but if you're looking at an inverted yield curve, isn't there an almost certain bet to let's see, what do? You buy the short end and sell the long end?
Sure, but what I was referring to, and I'm sorry, I probably didn't get it out clearly enough. I apologize. Is that we don't know whether the long end is going to go up or the short end is going to go down.
Right.
So to simply say, the yield curve has to return to normal, and so therefore, longer rates will be higher. We don't know that, and that's why I say the best sort of expectation is what's embedded into the yield curves today, because we don't know which way it's going to pivot.
Right. Well, this is that's great. And as and I think it's become apparent in our conversation, it's a very complicated, set of considerations. And I think you made this point early on, which is that don't think about, what's out there. Think about your own situation, because if you everybody's different and everybody's needs are different and everybody's liabilities are different and everybody's, so everybody should have their own specific investment plan, decumulation plan or retirement income strategy. And taking account of some of the concepts that you've laid out, Mendel, I think is well advised of anybody. We only have a couple minutes left. So is there any final thoughts that you'd like to share with my audience, which is basically advisors advising individuals on how to develop a decumulation or retirement income strategy for their clients?
Yeah, I will offer one closing thought. We lived through many years with extremely low interest rates. Some countries had negative interest rates. We had a little dip with negative interest rates. But they were 0 or 1 or 1.5 or 1.25. Today the 10-year treasury is back to almost 5. And that pretty much drives everything, kind of intermediate term, fixed income. And what that allows people to do is to achieve their goals without taking some of the risk of the equity markets. And
Ah.
so my comment is not being negative about the equity markets. People have made large amounts of money by buying and holding the equity markets. But at today's valuation levels, it's sort of worth thinking about, how much can you achieve your goals with somewhat less risk in the fixed income world.
That's very, very good advice. So thank you very much, Mendel. And thank you so much for being a guest on here. It's been extremely useful and helpful for me, as well as I hope our audience.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you all, gentlemen. This was great. What an interesting conversation from two really educated, experienced money men. So thank you, Mendel, for being on the show. Thank you, Pete. I'm Hope Katz-Gibbs, producer of this wonderful podcast and video show on the Incandescent Radio Network and Incandescent TV. And we will talk to you next month and have another fascinating guest on. So everyone, have a great evening. And thank you again, Pete and Mendel. We'll talk to you both soon.